Hi, Monica. Good to see you. And happy days, everyone. So we are here for the guiding light. And of course, during this time right now, I'm sharing from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. What I'm going to do is play a song before we get started. This is a kind of a fun song. It's about how the lady is singing how she needs to have her time with God in the morning, or else when the day gets crazy, she gets crazy, right? But if she starts her day with God, she can stay centered throughout the day. But it's a fun song. It's Francesca Battistelli.
Here I go, tiptoeing to the kitchen. And don't you know, crash goes the coffee cup. My only chance to be still and listen. Lord, don't let the kids wait. Pushed and pulled by a thousand expectations, and all the roles that I'm supposed to play. To hit the ground, running's a temptation.
Hi again. So as I mentioned, I'm going to start sharing from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And I am on page 76. We are in the section that is called self-inquiry. And I'm going to begin with a devotee's question. Why should self-inquiry alone be considered the direct means to knowledge? And of course, the knowledge here means knowledge of the true self. Here's the answer from Ramana Maharshi. Because every kind of practice, except that of self-inquiry, presupposes the retention of the mind as the instrument for carrying on the practice. And without the mind, it cannot be practiced. The ego may take different and subtler forms at the different stages of one's practice, but it is never destroyed. When King Yanaka exclaimed, "Now I have discovered the thief who has been ruining me all along," he shall be dealt with summarily. The king was really referring to the ego or the mind. So again, the question is, why should self-inquiry alone be considered the direct means to knowledge? And recently, I don't remember if it was this teaching or if it was the I Am That teaching or what. But recently, I remember sharing with you all that self-inquiry, focusing on the I Am presence, awareness, watching awareness, just being, being presence, remaining as the witness. These are all different ways that people say the same thing. And so when Ramana Maharshi is referring to self-inquiry, he is not so specific as to say, you have to use the question, who am I? I mean, certainly that's his recommendation. But if you pay close attention to Ramana Maharshi, you'll notice he recommends other questions as well to have you pay attention to awareness or pay attention to the self. You know, for example, one question might be, who sees this or what sees this? Another question that he recommends from time to time is, you know, where did this thought come from? Right? So he has different questions that he recommends, and the real purpose of the questions obviously isn't to come up with an intellectual answer. The real purpose of the questions is to turn the attention to what we tend to call awareness, and then to let attention abide there. And of course, last week we did a fairly lengthy meditation where we practice self-inquiry in that way, where we use self-inquiry in order to turn the attention to awareness and to abide there. So what Ramana Maharshi is really saying when he says self-inquiry is the only direct means, what he's really saying is paying attention to truth, to the true self, to awareness, to consciousness is the only direct means. When I first started this spiritual path, pretty quickly, I was put on the path of A Course in Miracles. And A Course in Miracles focuses on removing the obstacles to love's presence. So with A Course in Miracles, instead of meditation and focusing on awareness, what we're really doing is watching our mind, primarily in the beginning, for grievances, inquiring to find out the cause of the grievance, the real cause, not the imaginary cause, and learning to let go of false beliefs. I don't remember exactly when this was, but somewhere, you know, probably in the first 2 or 3 years that I was on the spiritual path, and I was practicing the method of removing the blocks to love's presence, I received guidance to also start focusing on and embracing truth. In fact, the way that guidance came to me, I was told it was the middle path. I was told that some people focus almost completely on letting go of the obstacles to love's presence, and some people focus almost exclusively on attention to the divine, and that what I was to do was to walk the middle path, doing both. I was to notice when my mind was engaged in falsehood, false beliefs, mental chatter, and take my attention away from that, let go of that. And I was also to be engaged in placing my attention with truth, with awareness, and spending time there. And even when my inner guidance seemed to come in the form of Ramana Maharshi through the teachings of Inner Ramana, even Inner Ramana taught me really what we would call that middle path. Inner Ramana did it differently, but remember there was the little S, self-inquiry, which was letting go of the faults, and then the big S, self-inquiry, which was paying attention to the true. But of the two, of those two methods, the one that is typically called the direct path is paying attention to the true. So Ramana Maharshi then has recommended self-inquiry, which is, you know, his form of turning attention to the truth. so that we can focus on the truth, he has recommended self-inquiry as the direct path. And he says, every kind of practice except that of self-inquiry presupposes the retention of the mind as the instrument for carrying on the practice. So let's look at root cause inquiry for a moment, which I have taught most of y'all, which is a form of discovering false beliefs and looking at false beliefs and hopefully letting go of false beliefs. When I've taught you root cause inquiry, there are things that you have to be able to do. Like you have to ask, why did this upset me? And you'll hear the story. Can I accept that if I was enlightened, this would not have upset me? Yes. Well, then why did this upset me? And looking a little deeper in. Why did I feel that way? And looking a little deeper in. What was I believing? And looking a little deeper in. And what's happening in this case when you're practicing root cause inquiry is you are using the mind to get to the root of some upset so that you can see what you're believing, see your false beliefs, and begin to let them go. And that's a very important part of the spiritual path. And I, of course, used it for many, 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 many years. But eventually I came to a point of realizing that I needed to let go of root cause inquiry. And the reason I needed to let go of root cause inquiry, it helped me to get to a certain place on the spiritual path. But if I was to continue to use that tool, it would be like continuing to use the math skills that you learned in first grade and not trading them in for higher math skills. So eventually I had to let go of root cause inquiry and I had to shift into new practices. And right now, although certainly still watching the mind throughout the day and letting go of, mental chatter is an important part of what I do, I have been told by my inner guidance that the most important thing I do now is meditation, awareness, watching awareness, or loving consciousness. It's as if the other practices, which really are purification practices, the other practices clear away enough crap so that the light that you need to focus on becomes apparent. And then the job becomes focusing on that. I'm pretty certain that in my case, when I first started this spiritual path, if I had been introduced to Ramana Maharshi and self-inquiry right away, I just wouldn't have got it. I mean, I can just see myself now. I could just see myself sitting down and closing my eyes and asking, who am I? Regina. Who am I? Regina, Jasmine's mom. Because that's just where I was, right? There would have been nothing in me that was all aware of awareness, even though, of course, awareness was completely present. There would have been nothing in me that was at all aware of awareness. So it would have been impossible at that stage for me to turn my attention to awareness and focus on awareness. And so I needed to go through A Course in Miracles and NTI and the purification process. That cleared some stuff away. And then, of course, it was the teachings of Inner Ramana, which came after NTI, the teachings of Inner Ramana, and most specifically, the practice of the mantra, I am that, as well, practicing the mantra, I am that I am, I am that I am, that I began to intuit, sense, know awareness. And not only did I intuit, sense, know awareness, I knew it was what I am. And not until that stage could I have practiced awareness, watching awareness. Right? I wouldn't even have known what those words meant. So there was a certain amount of purification, at least in my case, that needed to occur before I was even ready for the direct path. And then, as I became ready for the direct path, it was extremely difficult in the beginning, extremely difficult. When I would try to close my eyes and meditate and focus on awareness, one of two things happened. Either I just sat there with my eyes closed watching my thinking. I don't know if you guys have done that. Or I fell asleep. It was either just completely, you know, the only way I was alert was just being as into my mind as any other time. And if I started turning my attention away from the mind, I got very, very sleepy. And so I still needed a lot of, what I did then was a lot of contemplation. There was a lot of contemplation along with the meditation. And the real purpose for the contemplation at this phase of the journey wasn't so much purification. Of course, purification is never done till the ego's dead. But enough purification had occurred that that was no longer my primary function. Now my primary function was to increase my motivation to sit and stare at the truth. And so what really happened next was two to three years of intense contemplation every morning using the seven steps to awakening, which was increasing my desire. And during these first two or three years with the seven steps to awakening, I was hardly ever even attempting to meditate, because every time I meditated, it was an abysmal failure in my humble opinion. Like I said, I just sat and watched myself think, or I fell asleep. There was no meditating happening. But at some point, that second stage of increasing my desire to just sit in the truth, just be the truth, just abide as the truth, just watch is the word Michael Langford uses. It's really, to me, it's pay attention to the truth. At some point, that increased enough that my experience meditating began to shift. And now, as you guys know, I can close my eyes. I can move into awareness, watching awareness fairly quickly. And I can stay there for as long as my day will allow. You know, I have a pretty busy life, so I'm not one of these people that meditates 3 or 4 hours a day. The max right now for me tends to be 2 hours. But I can stay there for as long as that day will allow. And when I stop, I never stop because I was falling asleep, or because I couldn't sit still anymore, or because my mind wanted to go to things, because my mind was like, come on, you got to stop meditating. You got to go do this. Like, that never happens anymore. I just stop because the alarm goes off and it's time. Otherwise, I think I could sit there longer. So there's been kind of like these three primary stages leading up to this time where meditation is now the primary practice. The first stage was purification. The second stage was increasing my desire to abide with just awareness of truth and nothing else. And then the third stage that I'm experiencing now is that practice. And I do practice self-inquiry. Well, self-inquiry and loving consciousness together for me. Those are the two methods together that work very well, that allow me to sit in awareness, watching awareness. So I guess the reason I said all that is because although it's the direct path, and I totally agree with that statement that paying attention to awareness is the direct path, it may not be the path a particular person is ready for now. In fact, often Ramana Maharshi would talk about how a person needs to be ripe for self-inquiry. And so I don't think people should ever feel guilty or beat themselves up if at this point they are not yet able to really sit and meditate for a long period of time. I think, in my humble opinion again, what's most important is to realize what stage you are at and to focus your attention on that stage. And if you focus your attention on that stage, the next stage will come along naturally when you're ready. I think it's great if right now you're attempting to meditate for like even 30 minutes a day. I think that's great. But if 30 minutes a day is really enough for you, and journaling and root cause inquiry is still where you need to be. And then Len has asked a question, what happens when you meditate? Is there guidance? The answer to that is no. And let me explain and of course, everybody uses words differently, which is kind of a drag because then people can get confused. But let me share what I mean by contemplate and what I mean by meditate. I receive guidance when I contemplate, not when I meditate. When I contemplate, I am open to receive wisdom. That's the position I'm in. I'm open to receive wisdom. And every single time I contemplate, I receive wisdom. And we can call that guidance every time. When I meditate, I am turning my attention away from all thought. including that which we would call wisdom. I'm turning my attention away from all thought. Let me explain this in another way, because it took me a while also to realize this. You know, you realize different things along the path. When I first started as a Course in Miracles student, I used to think the goal was what we called the Holy Spirit, the right mind, wisdom. I thought that was the goal. Actually, it isn't. And in fact, even the Course doesn't say it's the goal. The Course calls the Holy Spirit a bridge. But I thought that was the goal. So I thought that the goal was to hear, to speak, to act from only that wisdom. And I thought that was the end of the road. But as I approached being able to do that, and I'm not saying 100%, but to live, you know, primarily from that wisdom, I began to notice something else. I began to notice, again, awareness. And I began to notice that there was something, which is me, but that there was something that was aware of the wrong mind and aware of the right mind. Therefore, it was beyond both. And I began to realize that the goal wasn't the right mind. The goal was that which was beyond both the right mind and the wrong mind. In fact, I remember very specifically laying in bed one day with what I called an ego attack at the time, which means my wrong mind was yip, 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 you know, just going crazy. I was experiencing fear. And I was watching the wrong mind, watching everything that wrong mind was saying. And then I heard the right mind come in, and I heard the right mind come in and ask me to take a deep breath and practice rest, accept and trust and trust that this is healing, and this too shall pass. And then I noticed me. I noticed that I was aware of both the wrong minds, yep, 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 and the right mind's comforting guidance, but that I was neither. I was neither. I was beyond both. It was the first time I really saw it that way. But if you really look at it, if you go back and look at NTI Romans chapter 2, NTI Romans talks about you who had this crazy mad idea, what if things were different than they are? And out of that idea came two options. One option was that things are as they are and they can't be different. That's the right mind. The other option was that things had changed and were completely different. And it says that's where you gave your believing attention. You tossed the first option aside and gave all of your attention to the idea that things were different. But let's look at that little piece of story again. First, there was you. Then there was a tiny mad idea. And then out of that came two options, a right mind and a wrong mind. You see, you were and are before both. That's awareness. So it's completely before the mind. And in fact, if we look back at what Ramana Maharshi is saying right now, again, he says, every kind of practice except that of self-inquiry presupposes the retention of the mind as the instrument for carrying on the practice. So when I thought that the right mind was the goal, I still had to pay attention to the mind, the right mind, yes, but I had to pay attention to the mind. I couldn't move back before the mind to where I really am as long as I thought that the mind was the goal. If I thought just receiving guidance and paying attention to guidance and following guidance was what this was all about, you could say I would progress to a certain point and then I would stall at that point and never actually know the true self. And I would become attached to the right mind, which I'm sure is much better than being attached to the wrong mind. What we are is beyond mind entirely. And so that's the advantage of self-inquiry or awareness watching awareness or focusing on the I am presence, is that takes you beyond mind entirely. That takes you to see yourself as that which contains everything. The world is in you. The body, the person that you typically think you are is in you. The wrong mind is in you. The right mind is in you. But you are beyond it all. So again, Ramana Maharshi says, every kind of practice except that of self-inquiry presupposes the retention of the mind as the instrument for carrying on the practice. And without the mind, it can't be practiced. The ego may take different and subtler forms at different stages of one's practice, but is itself never destroyed. Now that's a really important sentence. In fact, let me read it again before I talk about it, just in case you weren't listening. So this is the really important sentence. The ego may take different and subtler forms at the different stages of one's practice, that is itself never destroyed. So what that means is, let's say, you know how they have before and after pictures, like if you're losing weight. Let's talk about before and after purification in that same way, right? So before purification, when your wrong mind is completely full blown and you believe every bit of it, you know, whether you know it or not, a lot of suffering is going on. You're carrying around a lot of grievances. You're anxious about a lot of things. You get annoyed at a lot of things, frustrated at a lot of things. You know, you may be like me and able to lie to yourself and say that you're happy, but actually you're suffering, right? You're suffering. After you go through purification, there's peace. You know, there's happiness. There's the ability to be with what is as it is. So at this stage, the ego is much more subtle than it was before purification, but it's not dead. You know, you still think you are the person, just a more peaceful person, a happier person. You still see yourself as something different from other people and from other things in the world. You do not yet know yourself as consciousness. So although the experience is moving towards truth, you could say, you have a more peaceful experience, it is not yet the experience of truth. So purification itself can bring you to what we could call a state of inner peace, a state of inner peace. And if you continue the practices that brought you to that state of inner peace, you can really probably live out your whole life in that state of inner peace. But that's not really awake. It's just a state of inner peace because you've learned how to not believe the suffering anymore, the suffering in your own mind. One thing about this state of inner peace is because the ego is not dead, it's not permanent. Which means if you don't continue to watch the mind in the way you did in the beginning, little ideas will start to seep back in. And you'll start to move towards full-blown ego again. Somewhere I read, and I don't remember exactly where it was, but somewhere I read Ramana Maharshi saying, if there is one thought that is still alive or believed, I don't remember what word he used, not dead, you know, one thought that remains, giving attention to one, that one thought is enough to bring back the entire ego. You know, you could think of it as a seed that fell from the ego tree. And even though you've cut down what seems like the ego tree, if there's a seed and you start giving your attention to that seed, you're starting to water that seed and a whole new tree can grow out of it. So what masters like Ramana Maharshi say is that this job is not done until the ego is dead, completely dead. There's no seed, there's no tree, there's no seed. And so the purpose, again, of the direct path of just focusing on awareness is not only focusing on truth and bringing truth more into your awareness, but it's also not focusing on the ego. And since the ego thrives on attention, is fed by attention, when you're sitting in meditation focusing on awareness, the ego is dying of malnourishment. So Ramana Maharshi says, the ego may take different and subtler forms at the different stages of one's practice, but is itself never destroyed. Meaning, if you have not yet moved to the stage where you're focused on the direct path, focused on giving all of your attention to awareness, if you stay at the stage of just letting go of thoughts when they show up, watching the mind and letting go of thoughts, you know, you'll have a much more subtle ego than before. But the ego will not die. You need to begin to give your full attention to truth. He says, when King Yanaka exclaimed, "Now I have discovered the thief who has been ruining me all along. He shall be dealt with summarily." The king was really referring to the ego or the mind. And so the devotee says, but the thief may well be apprehended by other practices as well. And I just want to say something here. You know, when I read I Am That with Nisargadatta Maharaj, or I read, the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, I find often devotees who come and ask a question of a master. The master gives the answer, and the devotee says, yeah, no. You know, like Ramana Maharshi has just explained that self-inquiry, or really we could call it awareness, watching awareness, it's the same thing, is the only direct means to end the ego. And then the person who asked the question turns around and says, but the thief, meaning the ego, may well be apprehended by other practices as well. In other words, you know, I don't believe you. So the reason I bring that up is that's something for each of us just to pay attention to, that type of I know arrogance. If we get the opportunity to ask someone who's ahead of us on this path a question, especially if we get the chance to ask a great master a question, it behooves us to not argue with the answer. This is one of the things that Michael Langford tells us in The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss. You know, he talks about several ways that the ego will try and not hear the teaching, and one of it is creating arguments against it. You could at least not argue for 24 hours, right? Even if you can't tell your mind, I'm never going to argue this point, you could at least not argue for 24 hours. Give yourself a chance to sleep on it. Give yourself a chance to wake up with inner wisdom, to ask inner wisdom about it, right? And maybe before that 24 hours is over, you will see the master's point of view, the teacher's point of view. I know that in my own experience, although I can't remember specific instances right now, but I know in my own experience, you know, I have read great masters like Ramana Maharshi or Nisargadatta Maharaj, and there were things that my mind disagreed with. And what I decided to do was just to trust that I wasn't mature enough to understand yet, and that one day I would. And just leave it at that. Not argue and not, you know, put myself through, you know, all kinds of pretzel yoga stretches and stuff trying to get it, but just trust that one day I would understand. And so far that's always happened. You know, I'll come to a point where I'm reading something that I read years ago that my mind wanted to argue with, and now I see that way myself, right? So watch that tendency to argue with a master. Watch that tendency to think you know. If you're going to a teacher and asking questions, I promise you, you don't know yet. When the awareness awakens to the point that you could call it knowledge, you don't have questions anymore. You aren't going to anybody asking questions. Because any question you could possibly have, the answer is provided as quickly as the question. So if you're asking questions of a teacher, it actually means you don't know, therefore you shouldn't argue. And it's just funny how often we see that in these devotees. So again, this devotee says, but the thief may well be apprehended by other sadhanas or other practices as well. Ramana Maharshi says, the attempt to destroy the ego or the mind through practices other than self-inquiry is just like the thief turning out a policeman to catch the thief, that is, himself. It's just like the thief turning out a policeman to catch the thief, that is, himself. I'm not exactly sure with that language what that means. Maybe it means that the thief and the policeman are the same person, right? He's showing up as a policeman, said, oh yeah, I'll go get him, I'll go catch him, when he's actually by night the thief. Self-inquiry alone can reveal the truth that neither the ego nor the mind really exists, and enables one to realize the pure, undifferentiated being of the self or the absolute. And again, that's a really important sentence. Self-inquiry alone can reveal the truth that neither the ego nor the mind really exists. You know, when you're practicing root cause inquiry, and again, this is an important stage at some point. Like I said, I never would have gotten to awareness watching awareness if I hadn't purified to the point that I noticed awareness, right? That had to happen first. But when you're using root cause inquiry, you're listening to the mind. In fact, I practice root cause inquiry typically with the ego. I was asking the ego, why are you upset? And then I was paying attention to its answers from a detached point of view. But I'm literally conversing with the ego. Why does that bother you? Why does that bother you? Why do you feel that way? You know, so in a way, although it was a healthier way than believing the mind, in a way, I'm still engaging the ego. And I can't actually practice root cause inquiry without engaging the ego. And so since I'm engaging the ego and having a conversation with the ego, asking the ego why it's upset, I guarantee you I'm not seeing that the ego doesn't exist. I'm seeing that it's wrong. Maybe, you know, if I have enough awareness, I'm seeing what it believes. And I'm seeing how what it believes affects me. And I'm seeing that it's helpful to let go of those beliefs, but I'm not yet seeing that it doesn't exist. And in fact, I remember at an earlier stage on my path, you know, every now and then I would hear a teacher that would say, the ego doesn't even exist. And I felt this contraction, because, you know, I believed it did exist. It did exist, and I had to overcome it, right? I had to overcome it. Even when we use language like kill the ego, I mean, now that language doesn't really affect me in the way it used to because I know what it means. But used to, I thought like there was some ego here that had to be killed. There was something bad here that had to be eradicated. But when I practice awareness watching awareness, I'm able to sit back and see the mind has nothing but, you know, shadowy echoes of past attention. You know, like I think I told you all recently that Jasmine and I went to New York City for a weekend. And when I came back, my first meditation after we were back, because I confess I didn't meditate while in New York City. When I came back, my first meditation was filled with thoughts about New York City. And I thought, look at that. You know, like, it's just a shadowy echo of the fact that I was in New York City the last 2 days. Like, there's nothing here. And then not only do you see that it's a shadowy echo of the past, which is really what it is, even if it's talking about the future, when you really look at it, it's talking about the future through your past experience. So when you start looking at the shadowy echo, and then you start asking, you know, what is this? What am I? It's like a vapor that just disappears. And you see there's nothing there. And you can also see your own reality. Your own reality shines so clearly, and the shadowy vapor that the ego appeared to be just kind of breaks up and disappears, and it becomes incredibly obvious what's real and what's not real. But that happens through self-inquiry or through awareness watching awareness. In other words, that's the stage where you begin to see that the mind is nothing. At least for me, before that stage, I couldn't see that the mind is nothing, that the ego is nothing. It was something that had to be overcome. And I'm sure many of y'all still feel that way right now, right? It is something that you have to overcome. And I think that's the way it is when we're going through the purification phase. But through awareness, watching awareness, we come to see it's nothing. It literally has no reality, zero reality. And the only thing that's real is you. And that's powerful. That changes everything. So Ramana Maharshi says, the attempt to destroy the ego or the mind through practices other than self-inquiry is just like the thief turning out a policeman to catch the thief. Oh, now I understand the language. He's not saying the thief and the policeman are the same one. He's saying the thief is the one that's calling the policeman and, you know, giving him information to go chase after that thief when he's actually the thief himself. So he's sending him off in the wrong way. It's just like the thief turning out a policeman to catch the thief, that is, himself. Self-inquiry alone can reveal the truth that neither the ego nor the mind really exists. Let me pause for a moment and talk about that word exist again. Exist means that it is, and this is very poor English, it bees. It bees, it is on its own power, right? It doesn't need anything to make it be or to make it is. And you see, that's also what you see when you're practicing awareness, watching awareness. Like I said, the ego, the mind, the mental chatter, it is just a shadow of past attention. You know, I give my attention to New York City for 2 days and I close my eyes to meditate and the images and the thoughts are about New York because I gave my attention to New York for a couple of days. But without my attention having been on New York, like if I had just been here in Pueblo West the whole time and hadn't given a single thought to New York, those thoughts about New York wouldn't have been in the mind. Because the mind doesn't have its own existence, doesn't have its own life. It's an appearance, an apparition that is fed by attention. It does not have its own beingness. It does not exist. Because in order to exist, it has to exist on its own power, on its own beingness. And the mind just doesn't have that. It's fed by your attention. You, however, are completely different. And of course, by you, I mean awareness, not the body, mind, personality. But you are completely different. You do exist. You do exist on your own power. You just are. There's nothing there that makes you or creates you, which is amazing but true. Even though people love to say God created me, at some point, you know, you transcend that scene. There's nothing that creates you. You just are. And if everything else disappears, you still are. There's just no object for you to be aware of. So you exist. The ego and the mind doesn't exist. And that's what you see as you practice awareness, watching awareness. You notice your ongoing reality, and you notice that the mind does not have that reality, especially as you meditate and the mind drops silent. When the mind drops silent, it isn't there. There's really no such thing as a silent mind. That's just a term that we use. Mind is thought. Thought is mind. So when there is no thought, there is no mind. It's not really a silent mind. It's just no mind. But when there's no mind, you still are. And you can see that. Right? You can see that. You can see there that the mind is a temporary mechanism that seems to appear because of attention, and that you are permanent, changeless, and you require nothing in order to exist. You just are. So self-inquiry alone can reveal the truth that neither the ego nor the mind really exists, and enables one to realize the pure undifferentiated being of the self or the absolute, which of course is what I was just speaking about. Having realized the self, nothing remains to be known because it is perfect bliss. It is the all, right? Self-realization. So 7 minutes. Wow, it's kind of a long time and kind of a short time. I guess we'll try reading this. We'll see what happens. Usually I don't cover a whole answer in 7 minutes. So what the heck? Let's give it a try. So the devotee says, in this life, beset with limitations, can I ever realize the bliss of the self? And Ramana Maharshi says, that bliss of the self is always with you, and you will find it for yourself if you seek it earnestly. The cause of your misery is not in the life without. It is in you as the ego. You impose limitations on yourself and then make a vain struggle to transcend them. All unhappiness is due to the ego. With it comes all your trouble. What does it avail you to attribute to the happenings in life the cause of misery, which is really within you? What happiness can you get from things extraneous to yourself? When you get it, how long will it last? If you would deny the ego and scorch it by ignoring it, you would be free. If you accept it, it will impose limitations on you and throw you into a vain struggle to transcend them. That was how the thief sought to ruin King Janaka. To be the self that you really are is the only means to realize the bliss that is ever yours. So twice in here, Ramana Maharshi commented on the fact that the ego imposes limitations on us and then we struggle to transcend them. I think that's what I was talking about a little earlier when I said that, you know, once upon a time to me, the ego was real and I had to overcome it. I remember, which now to me seems silly, but I remember when I was a course student, thinking that guilt was a real thing. Almost like, in fact, I even read this in a book. Some of you guys might recognize the book. Almost like I had this iceberg of guilt in me down here, right? This iceberg of guilt. I was only aware of this top up here. And I had to keep practicing root cause inquiry and keep pushing that guilt up, 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 up until I got rid of every single little bit of it. And until I got all of that guilt out of the subconscious, I could not be free. And then one day I realized, there's no guilt. My God, it's just a thought. It's just a belief. There has never, ever, ever, ever been any guilt. There's no iceberg to melt, you know? I don't have to keep looking, keep looking, keep looking till I get all of it. There's nothing there. You see, that's the freedom. It's not imposing the limitation on you, the belief that there's guilt that you have to overcome, you know, or unworthiness that you have to overcome, or there's fear that you have to overcome, or, you know, name whatever your thing is. It's actually seeing, not believing, because believing is just spiritual ego, it's just more crap. But it's actually seeing that those things don't exist. Right? That's when you're free, when you realize there is genuinely no guilt, there is genuinely no unworthiness, there is genuinely no fear. You can have the experience of fear by giving your believing attention to fear thoughts, but there isn't any repressed fear. I used to think there was this repressed fear, like I had built a mountain of fear in me with all of my past thoughts, and that whole mountain that I had built was some kind of an actual thing, and every bit of it had to come up or I couldn't be free. None of that's true. Right? So the ego imposes these limits on us, and then we work hard to transcend them when really all we have to see is there's no ego, there's no fear, there's no guilt, there's no unworthiness, right? None of that actually is, but we have to genuinely see it. It doesn't do any good to walk around saying there is no ego when you're totally believing your thoughts and acting from them, right? That's just bull. So Ramana Maharshi again says, the cause of your misery is not in the life without, right? So it's not other people or politics or anything like that. It is in you as the ego, which is your believing attention on thought. You impose limitations on yourself by believing them and then make a vain struggle to transcend them, right? All unhappiness is due to the ego. With it comes all your trouble. What does it avail you to attribute to the happenings in life the cause of misery, which is really within you? And then he recommends, if you would deny the ego and scorch it by ignoring it, you would be free. And again, that's the purpose of self-inquiry or awareness watching awareness. You focus completely on awareness, but you're also completely ignoring the ego. And the ego doesn't exist. It thrives on your attention. So without your attention, it ceases to appear. It seemed to be not real. It seemed to not exist. You know, you can't feel guilt if you don't give believing attention to thoughts that say you're guilty. Right? It's not real. It's made up. And so with that, I'm out of time. So I'm going to release the mic, and I want to thank y'all for hanging out with me. And as to those people right there in the retreat house, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow, 10 a.m. We will begin an entire week of self-inquiry, all right? See you tomorrow. I'll probably be there around 9 to set up, but we'll begin at 10. Bye.